Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Well, I hope everything is good with you, in whichever corner of the world you reside, and here in London, well, we've got the usual ups and downs of weather here, bit of freezing cold, little bit of stormy and wet, and I am counting off the days like a kid with a Christmas advent calendar, to the arrival of spring. It's going to be some weeks yet, but we are over the hump. We're past the 21st of December, thank the Lord, and we're heading towards something better, I hope. Thank you very much for all of your emails. Still a little behind on those. Remembering, of course, if you email me, you can do that through the website, theunexplained.tv. Please tell me who you are, where you are, how you use the show, and if you have a specific query, please tell me what it is that you require. You know, I cannot respond if I don't know what it is that I'm responding to. And if you need a response, please put in the subject line, response required. And if I haven't got back to you yet, drop me a reminder. Life is very, very silly. Not only the world of doing shows and stuff like that, but everything else in this life of ours. But anyway, we tread our way cautiously through 2024, don't we? Okay, thanks very much to Adam, my webmaster, for his involvement in the show, for getting the shows out to you, maintaining the website, which is theunexplained.tv. I heartily recommend you to check out my Facebook page, the official Facebook page of The Unexplained with Howard Hughes. Now, I don't normally recommend TV programs here, but I do recommend a drama that I saw a couple of nights ago and left a big impact on me personally. It is the life story of Archie Leach, a.k.a. the movie star Cary Grant. Now, this guy was born in very difficult circumstances in Bristol in the UK, moved to America, became a star in the United States, a very good-looking guy who became an instant hit in the movies, it seemed, went to incredible heights, had a number of challenges in his life to overcome, and the wonderful thing that I have to say left me very emotional at the end of it, and quite hopeful too, that he was a man who overcame an awful lot of challenges and towards the end of his life ended up fulfilled and happy and understanding things. If you want a lesson in life, I recommend Archie, that is the story of Cary Grant. At the moment in the United Kingdom, it's available on ITVX, their player. And, I watched it all on my phone in one evening. I could not put it down. Was that good? Now, I don't do this normally, but I just think as a human study that has, I think, takeaway points for all of us, including me, it's great. Now, the guest on this edition of The Unexplained, controversial, Ashton Forbes, from my radio show recently. I want to put the whole thing here, so you're going to hear it exactly as it was recorded here and broadcast on the radio. Ashton Forbes is a man who has a unique take on the case of missing flight MH370. In March this year, it will be 10 years since the loss of that plane and the more than 200 people on board. A terrible tragedy. A lot of effort has gone, we are told, into finding the wreckage of the plane and getting answers about this. But we're still asking questions 10 years on. How can that be? Ashton Forbes has a unique take on it. And I have to say, as I would say on the radio, you know, the views that you will hear are his views. They are not my views. They are not the views of anybody who might employ me or the views of my website or the views of my webmaster. They're Ashton Forbes' views. And I think they're interesting. Your thoughts on them, of course, welcome. And I know, as you will hear in the conversation, he welcomes your thoughts too. So he's the guest on this edition of The Unexplained. Thank you for suggesting him. We found him and we got him on the show. I don't think I have anything else to say at this point, so let's get to the conversation from my radio show about Flight MH370, a tragic case. This is Ashton Forbes. The disappearance of a passenger plane, something that you would think in this surveilled world of ours would be impossible to happen. Just to remind you, MH370, Malaysia Airlines, was going from Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia to the Chinese capital Beijing when it lost contact and disappeared March 2014, so we are coming up to that anniversary. Despite many, many attempts to trawl different parts of the ocean for the plane or its wreckage, it's never been found, and the fate of the 239 souls on board in total has never been determined, which must lead and has led to endless heartbreak for those connected with them, their families, their friends, people who worked with them, They never got an answer. Will they ever get an answer? Ashton Forbes is a citizen journalist and organizer of MH370X, an investigation group. And he's online to us now because he's got some thoughts about this that have been getting a lot of coverage lately. Ashton, thank you very much indeed. How are you?
Hey, Howard, doing great. I appreciate you and your listeners kind of listening to the case that we're going to be presenting here today.
Why do you think that it never ceases to be of interest to people? Why do you think that it continues to bug people who are not connected with the case?
Yeah, I think that that one's got a simple answer, which is that we know that a 777 can't disappear, especially in a post-9/11 world, let alone in 2014, where we have proven as part of this investigation that we have satellites everywhere. We have a literal global persistent infrared surveillance network that is scanning the entire world all the time. And the debris field from a 777 crashing into the ocean would be visible from space very easily. So the fact that this plane supposedly just disappeared and the official most extensive and expensive search in human history was not able to find one piece of the plane above or below water or the black boxes doesn't make any sense. And I think that the thing that bugs people too, especially those who've watched the documentary on Netflix about it, is that they say that we found a couple pieces of this plane that washed up by someone who was independent, not related to the investigation, the official search at all, and that everybody just says, oh, well, that means it must have crashed, and therefore we're not going to look into it anymore. And I think that a lot of people that can think logically know that there's something amiss here, that this does not add up to the story we've been told.
Well, it certainly sounds like it, and every time somebody investigates it, every time you read a newspaper article or piece about it, there's another little piece of the jigsaw that may or may not fit. For example, there's the piece that was left hanging literally in the air a few years ago about people on the Maldives hearing something that may well have been this plane at around exactly the same time. Now, that geographical location does not fit with where the plane should have been, but that's just one of many stories that have emerged over the years about the plane that have led us nowhere.
Yeah, the Maldives is a very interesting case because the Maldives was intentionally excluded from the search. And there's two very important pieces of evidence that came out of the Maldives. One is a B777 fire suppression device that washed up weeks later on one of the islands. You can see pictures of it. You can Google it. You can see there's even a serial number on it. This is a very unique looking device. And it was just ignored and dismissed as not possibly being able to be from Malaysian Airlines. What other plane, what other B777 did this thing come from, if not Malaysian Airlines? And then the sighting in the island, about, I think, 20 different people potentially saw a giant jumbo jet so clearly flying low with the red and white stripe of Malaysian Airlines on it. And this was also just dismissed because the plane was supposedly not coming from the right direction. It was coming from the west and going south towards a very secretive military base that is down there. So, you know, I think that the idea and the main mistake that a lot of the original investigators, the independent group, et cetera, made was that they discounted a huge amount of evidence, including at least 19 witnesses. And that's not including the ones in the Maldives that supposedly saw the plane as well.
We've hinted at this. A lot of people have had their two cents worth over the last 10 years. People who are qualified and people who are there to speculate, but maybe not qualified. What in the middle of all of that made you want to get involved in this? What did you think that you could add?
Yeah, and what I would say is as part of this investigation, a thing that I've learned is that we can't blindly put stock in people who call themselves experts. When it comes to mysterious missing planes, there really is no precedent for someone to be an expert at that. Although I will say that, of course, people who are pilots and engineers definitely have very important pieces of evidence to add to the puzzle. For myself, I think that two videos had reemerged on social media, and I was always interested in any types of airplanes that crash in general, because I used to fly a lot for my job, and I'm actually afraid of flying, so I always want to know, what is the reason for them to crash? I never felt comfortable with the story that was told around Malaysian Airlines, but when I saw these two videos, I had remembered that I'd seen one back in 2014, and I thought that they were potentially just fake and dismissed them. And now when I looked at them again, I saw the second video that I had not seen back then. And they are two perfectly in sync videos, which just as a brief summary, seem to show the plane disappearing entirely after it gets surrounded by three orbs, which I think people would call UFOs, but I like to call Lockheed Martin technology, reverse engineer technology, perhaps even. And the videos are definitely too much for a lot of people to believe. And they would have been too much for me to believe even just a few years ago, probably. But now with all that we've been progressing scientifically and the scientific papers that are out there, including wormhole papers, unification theories of quantum and macro, I've come to believe that these videos are perhaps the most important evidence related to this missing plane. And they seem to tell the story of the plane that is consistent with all the evidence that's out there today, including the 19 witnesses, including the tiny amounts of the debris that washed up. And most importantly, the fact that we never found the plane anywhere. We never found a debris field. We never found any black boxes. There were no acoustic detections for a plane crashing into the ocean. There were at least four countries' radars that should have seen it flying in the South Indian Ocean, as well as three different military bases, Diego Garcia, Pine Gap, as well as there's a signals intelligence base in the Cocoa Islands. There's no way that the United States government doesn't know what happened to this plane. And that's pretty much what drives me to help get the truth for the families who know that there's something wrong here. And they know, too, that this plane didn't crash.
We'll talk about the videos later in this conversation, because it's interesting. And you will know those videos have been widely debunked. Why do you think, though, just before we get off that topic and we'll come back to it, why do you think that videos would just emerge like that? If those videos were around, surely they would have come out at some other point in the last 10 years.
Yeah, so, I mean, they did. Like I mentioned, I've seen them. I saw at least one of them, the one that is the MQ-1C drone thermal video back in 2014. A number of other people have also mentioned that they saw them as well. They have been out there. The original YouTube account, the oldest one that we can find, was deleted, and we can only find that on the Internet Archive. But there are other versions as well that were uploaded in the months afterwards in that same summer of 2014. A couple of them are even in higher quality than the one that we found, which would indicate that these videos were potentially leaked by a third-party source, that neither of them is the original in general. And so I think that the reason why they were dismissed is that it was too much. We had no idea what we were even looking at, especially in the one that is labeled satellite video, airliner, and UFOs. The prerequisites to even begin to understand these to be real is the 2017, 2018 DOD Navy UAP videos that were declassified that seemed that show us what FLIR, forward-looking infrared, looks like. Before that, I wouldn't even know what a drone video would look like. 2019, Trump posted a satellite picture of an Iranian, I believe it was a missile silo or launch area. And this actually showed us what satellite capabilities were. We had no idea before then, some of the most closely guarded secrets. And this showed us USA 224, which is a spy satellite, which has a very similar optical capability of what we're seeing in the satellite video of the MH370 videos. We had to understand, as I mentioned, these advanced theoretical physics concepts, which some of these are just coming out in like the last year, some of them last few weeks as well. This idea of ER equals EPR, which is how like a wormhole in general relativity equates to quantum entanglement from the quantum mechanics perspective. We need to also understand stuff like Bose-Einstein condensate, which is essentially how we can have a material that can change its phase state and go from being something that takes up a lot of space to now kind of condensing down to a single point. Then we also need to understand LK99, which is a metamaterial that has been debunked and now rebunked again, that is supposedly one of the best candidates for room temperature superconductivity. And room temperature superconductivity will change everything about the entire planet. That's how huge it is. And it turns out that's what I had been speculating, looking at these videos, would be required for these orbs to both be able to be defying gravity, as we can tell,
all right,
as well as creating the gravity engine. Go ahead.
Okay, we've got into it a little more deeply than I wanted to at this point, but I didn't want to stop you because it is so fascinating. Even if some people may say, well, that's unlikely, of course, if they say it's unlikely, they have to come out and prove to everybody, just as you're laying out your case, why they think it's unlikely, and I'm quite happy for them to do that. Let's just, in these minutes left in this segment then, wind back and tell the story of this flight. I mean, this is a flight that, from what I understand, is pretty routine. You know, it's a pretty routine bus journey in one particular area of the world, but not routine in some other ways, because there have been questions raised about what this flight actually had loaded on board. The manifest for it has had many questions asked about it, hasn't it?
Yeah, it definitely has. So just as a quick rundown, this flight pushed back 1630 UTC It took off from the runway at 1642 UTC from Kuala Lumpur. It was headed northeast to Beijing. 1719 UTC is that last communication that has been made publicly available. Good night, Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. No discernment in the pilot's voice whatsoever. 1721, 64 seconds later, the plane goes dark. This is where the investigators have said that this is when the ACARS was shut off, the computer systems. This is why supposedly it goes dark. The last radar contact was supposedly at 1730 UTC. This was the commercial radar. Military radar tracks this plane, but they obfuscate that for several days. They knew this plane did not crash into the South China Sea, and yet they searched there for at least 5 days afterwards. And this is where the public had no idea what was going on. So right away, there was a huge amount of obfuscation around what was happening to it. The Malaysian Minister of Defense contradicts himself several times. He gets asked why they wouldn't set planes up to track it. And he says, you know, why would we do that, to shoot down the plane? And the obvious answer is no, to track the plane and figure out where it's going. They even claim that they knew the plane was not hostile. And in the early days afterwards, the biggest speculation was some type of maintenance event, an issue with the plane in general. Now, if you know a plane's not hostile, there's not a lot of ways to know it's not hostile. One of the only ways is you still have communication with the plane. And there was even another Boeing 777 pilot going to Narita, to Tokyo. And they had contact with the plane at 1730 UTC. And they heard a bunch of static and the pilots on there as well, which casts a lot of doubt on this idea that the plane actually went dark at 1721 UTC. The communications potentially were still on. Now, this plane goes to Penang Airport, which was the closest airport that can accommodate a 777 in an emergency situation. This is not consistent with a pilot suicide scenario that has been presented in the media. This is more consistent with some type of emergency event that happened. There was the pilot's cell phone pings in Penang as well, meaning they had to be flying very low to ping a cell phone tower between 5,000 and 7,000 feet or lower, potentially. We don't know why they don't land there, but they don't. There's speculation that maybe the runway lights were not turned on. If there was an emergency event, like a fire, which is the scenario that we've presented, that perhaps it was too dangerous, they had to make a judgment call. And the next thing they were supposed to do after potentially trying to land on their belly on the land is to try to land in the ocean. So where does this plane fly to? Flies to the Andaman Sea, where the Cope Tiger exercises are currently going on between the United States, Thailand, and Singapore. Now, if this is a suicide scenario, this is a really weird place to go, where you're going to go where all the most advanced equipment is, that's going to be having radar that should easily be able to track a potential hostile craft coming into the exercise range. The day after the plane went missing, they said that Subang Air Traffic Control lost contact at 1840 UTC, which is the time that we presented that the videos take place based on the coordinates that we can see in the satellite video. Turns out this is actually the exact time and location where this narrative says that the suicidal pilot turned the plane into the South Indian Ocean. Yeah, we can find no evidence of a plane in the South Indian Ocean. The scenario that, and so another piece of evidence that's important, is that the Malaysian Airlines CEO denied that there was any dangerous cargo on board on, I believe it was on March 13th, the same time they were presenting the scenario of the plane flying to the South Indian Ocean. It wasn't until March 20th that the CEO came back and said, whoops, I was lying. There is 487 pounds, 221 kilograms of dangerous unscanned lithium ion batteries on board the plane, two pallets of which we're right next to the main equipment center, also known as the electronics bay. So if you go look at these videos, lithium ion battery fires, extremely dangerous and energetic events, something called runaway lithium ion battery fires, where they do not go out. You can put them out, but they just keep coming back up. Like those candles, that are those joke birthday candles where you blow it out and they come back up again.
At 30,000 feet or 15,000 feet, however many thousand feet, you might have a fire on board that you cannot tackle by standard means. And, you know, what would you do? But that doesn't explain why there was no, if that happened on board with a cargo like that, why would there not be a mayday?
Yeah, so I think that there maybe was a mayday. It wasn't reported in Western news. But so what I'll say is, given that flight path that I just presented, now let's bring in the 19 witnesses. You have Mike McKay that sees the plane on fire from an oil rig, very low on the horizon because of his distance. And he sees it on fire for 5 to 10 seconds. And this is at the exact same time when this plane goes dark. You have 9 witnesses along the coast between Thailand and Malaysia that all report hearing loud noises at that exact same time, as well as that's going to be consistent with the explosion, initial explosion of lithium ion batteries. Then 10 minutes later, same time that we had that 777 communication, there's eight fishermen 10 miles off the coast of Thailand and Malaysia. And these eight fishermen see the plane flying extremely low. This is going to be consistent with the pilot not trying to knock everybody out, but actually trying to either put out the fire, or they are trying to give enough oxygen to the passengers, because in a depressurization scenario, those oxygen masks are only going to last about 20 to 30 minutes, and they want to try to keep everybody awake and alive. Now, this plane gets past Penang, and it gets to our final witness, which is Catherine T. She's actually on a boat at that location where we say the plane supposedly turned in the South Indian Ocean. And this is an hour and 20 minutes later, and she sees this glowing orange plane with no navigation lights on it. She reports this sighting right after. She's got a blog post about it. She talked to all the investigators. She did multiple follow-up blog posts. If she's lying, she's been committed to that lie for over 8 years. And the orange glowing plane is consistent with the halon fire extinguishing devices releasing bromine from a chemical reaction. And bromine is a halogen gas. If you go look up halogen lamps and you compare it to the artist's recreation of her sighting, it's basically a perfect overlay.
And that, heat is like a blowtorch, isn't it? The only other thing, as we come to the end of this segment, Ashton, we'll pick this up. The only thing that would militate perhaps against that, and I'm speaking to you here as a layman, a journalist, just listening to what you say. If you have a fire of that intensity on board your plane, then you're not going to have much control of it for very long. If you're talking about heat of that kind, it's going to melt the plane, it's going to break it up, and it's going to do it fast. But this plane seemed to be under control for longer than that, didn't it?
So, yeah, and so what I'll say real quick on the Mayday call, and then I'll get to that part. So there was a Chinese-only reported Mayday call, supposedly at 2:43 a.m. If you convert that to Malaysian time and flip it over to UTC, that's 18:43 UTC. That's within 3 minutes of the time we suppose our videos took place here. And that Mayday call, again, only reported in China Times News, you can check it out if you want to find it, was that it was an intercepted communication by China of Malaysian Airlines saying that the plane was disintegrating and then attempting an emergency landing. Catherine T. also saw supposedly the plane trying to attempt a landing in the ocean. She thought it was trying to land in the ocean because of how low it was and how it was descending. Now, in terms of the plane lasting, you have to keep in mind the halon fire extinguishing devices, they can temporarily put these fires out. Those fire extinguishing devices can last for 3 hours. There's actually an article in the Daily Beast by an expert related to this that presented this theory. We actually just found this pretty recently in the last few weeks. And I've talked to somebody who's actually testified on Capitol Hill regarding the dangers of lithium ion batteries back in 2012, 2013. And they say that, yes, this plane could last for over an hour. The cargo bays are actually built to withstand fires as well. So you have to keep in mind, this is not a situation where this fire is raging. This is a situation where they're putting it out and it's coming back up again. Repeatedly, over and over again. Now, is this plane doomed? Absolutely. But is there some chance of hope for, you know, a rescue or potentially, you know, some type of Sully Sullenberger situation? Maybe it's a low chance, but there is a chance.
And are you saying here then that the fire may have been so intense that it disabled communication, that it made it impossible for any further radio traffic to happen beyond the one registered Mayday call?
My opinion is that they had communication with the plane and that that would be classified. And you may ask, well, what would be the reason for covering up this information related to just a fire? It's a normal event, right? And this is, they were speculating in a maintenance event early on, but this just didn't get any press, really. It didn't get put really into the ATSB reports. And the answer is the videos that we see. Everything lines up to the videos we see being real.
We were talking about the possibility of a massive lithium-ion battery fire on board. And I think many people will have seen on YouTube and other places what lithium-ion battery fires look like. Even small ones are utterly alarming. I mean, literally, if one of those things goes, you don't have a lot of chance to fight it. Your best bet is probably to get up. But if you have a cargo of that, then you've got a very, very serious and potentially terminal situation on board. If it is as straightforward as that, tragic nonetheless, it makes you question why there would be a lack of transparency around it.
Yeah. So the lack of transparency, again, I think, is related to the videos that we see. I mean, that's the part that is so compelling, is that the entire story adds up, but it only adds up if the videos are real, which is that this is an anomalous event that occurred that's so extraordinary that it needs to be covered up. Because otherwise, there's no reason why you would cover up this fire scenario. You would just say, oh, yep, there was a fire, plane flew the Andaman Sea near our Cope Tiger exercises. you know, we engaged it, maybe it crashed, maybe we tried to rescue the people as they were trying to land in the ocean because it was too dangerous to land on land. You know, if they were going to dump the fuel in a fire scenario, they might be afraid of the thing lighting up. And if they don't dump the fuel and they try to land potentially without landing gear, then again, the plane's going to explode. So the ocean landing, then if you're a pilot and you go to the list, you know, the ocean landing is the next thing you're supposed to do. I was also just on with Tim Pool, and a lot of people in the comments, or several pilots or supposed pilots, also mentioned that the changing the altitude as well would be consistent with this fire scenario. So it blows my mind that all of these experts that are out there have completely discounted all of the witnesses that all corroborate the same event, as well as this very likely scenario of these dangerous lithium ion batteries that were put together that same day. They were packaged completely unsafely, just stacked on top of one another in cardboard boxes.
How do you know that, by the way?
The ATSB report. You can just check it out yourselves. I think it's about page 256, if I recall correctly. And you can just see the pictures of it. These things look like improvised explosive devices, the way that they've stacked them up together. You know, just the thing about this case that's so compelling to me is early on when we started digging into these videos, I told myself if these videos are somehow real, then they're going to tell the real story of what happened to this plane. And it's going to be verifiable information. And it is. We found more stuff about it than I would have ever thought in my whole life. The fire scenario being corroborated by all these witnesses, I didn't even know all these witnesses corroborated it. Got to realize that early on, especially before this, I was never even into conspiracies or anything like this. I believed all of the official narratives. The first thing that I did was read the Whisper Report by Richard Godfrey, and I assumed this plane had to have crashed in the South Indian Ocean. I thought the videos must be taken in the South Indian Ocean. And it wasn't until I looked at the Inmarsat data myself, these pings that they say, and you can see very clearly at 1839, 1840 UTC, there's a huge anomaly in this XL data. And none of these investigators and experts have noticed that. It's beyond belief for me. So as hard as the stuff is to believe, especially around the science of what we might be dealing with, this idea that there might be advanced technology that's kept hidden from us, it somehow tells a better story than anyone else's story here to date. And I've been in touch with, I'd say, all of the independent group that's willing to talk to me, as well as other investigators like Florence DeChangy. I think that they find it to be too incredible, but some of them are at least willing to kind of discuss some of the finer points of the case with me.
Which is good, because that's the only way that we will learn. And perhaps the answer to it all is a synthesis of a lot of your investigations. I've spoken to Florence DeChangy. I've spoken to Richard Godfrey. I've spoken to Brian Wilson, you know, independent journalist in Sydney, an aviation journalist of a lot of repute. You know, those are among the people that I've spoken with over the last 10 years about this. And the other theories include that, as you say, there were some military exercises going on, that this plane could have been shot down, perhaps by accident, by a missile or by a plane. Enormously embarrassing. What a tragedy. How do you explain that? So you don't. You keep it quiet. I mean, that's one possibility. The Richard Godfrey, I've spoken to him a number of times, but one of the explanations that was reported in the papers from him, and also I spoke with him about, was that the pilot, revealed by amateur radio data, had flown the jet in circles to deliberately make sure that he couldn't be followed or tracked or whatever. What do you make of that thought?
Yeah, so first, the problem with the shoot down theory is that the debris field would have been hundreds of miles wide. You know, we've seen situations where debris fields have happened. I think back to 9/11, especially UA 93, where those people fought back and you have this debris field that's gigantic, right? Now, if a plane it's shot down in the sky at super high altitude, even at a low altitude, that debris field is going to be all over the place. So you're not going to be able to hide that. You're not going to be able to cover that up. There's no way to not see it. And that's the same problem I have with this plane supposedly crashing into the ocean. Now, I read, as I said, Richard Godfrey's Whisper Report. And even if you go back to my earliest, I used to do Twitter spaces pretty frequently about this, you'll see that I never really trusted the Whisper Report after the radar data runs out, because it just doesn't make any logical sense. He claims that they're like trying to hug the coast of Indonesia to avoid radar, but that doesn't make sense in an airplane. And that's not how you avoid radar anyway. If you are in a suicidal pilot scenario, you don't care about avoiding radar. Like, as Matthias Chang, who is a political advisor and lawyer in Malaysia to Prime Minister Mahathir, which is one of the longest tenured prime ministers in Malaysia ever, says is that you would just fly directly over Indonesia. If they send up jets to shoot you down, so what? You just dive down the plane. This is a suicidal scenario. You just crash the plane anytime. In fact, a Germanwings pilot who crashed a plane in 2015 after locking the co-pilot out, he crashed that plane in under 10 minutes. I don't think a lot of people even realize that. This idea that somebody went on an 8-hour joyride and flew by the closest airport to say goodbye to their hometown at 2 in the morning is completely illogical. The idea from the Whisper report that you're trying to ignore radar by going directly at the Cope Tiger exercises also makes no sense. Those radars would have picked it up anyway. This idea that they did a cutback, this is one of the things in this Whisper report that I read. It's almost like reading a bad movie. Like, oh, the pilot did a 270-degree cutback at this point to see if anyone was behind him. That's not something you can glean from random radio signals. And then what clearly happened is they ran out of data for tracking the plane, and there wasn't any data points. So they came up with this idea that they did a 25-minute holding pattern. That's not how you avoid any radars either. This is like a bad movie plot. This isn't real life that they're kind of talking about here. And we've dug into bases like Diego Garcia, which is in the Indian Ocean there, which supposedly has radar that can track the plane from takeoff to where it's at. So this idea that, oh, we're going to do a holding pattern here in the middle of the ocean, that might make sense if they're being led by the military and they're being told, hey, here's the location you're going to go to, which was what I initially thought when I read that. But it makes no sense from the suicidal pilot scenario at all.
A lot of attention was placed upon the pilot. In the couple of months after this terrible tragedy, Zahiri Ahmed Shah, I think his name was, and they went to his home. They saw that he had flight simulators, checked the things that had, flight simulator software, checked the things that he'd been running, the scenarios that he'd been trying. And people were, I think, at the time trying to put two and two together and make six out of that. And then that went away because a lot of people spoke up for him and said this was so unlikely, and there were so many other theories and suggestions and points coming out that again the attention deflected from him. But there are still people who say that this may have been deliberately brought down.
Yeah, then there's just no evidence for it whatsoever, like literally none at all. Like you mentioned, everybody stood up for him. There was a huge amount of disinformation where people were just putting out fake stuff about him, saying that his political, because of the person he voted for, that he was a terrorist or that his wife was leaving him. That's just all false. Again, the officials stood up for him. His wife stood up for him. All his coworkers did. He had 18,000 flight hours.
Did you talk to any of those people?
I did not talk to them personally. This is all just from reporting that everybody can find. The other thing I want to say real quick is that nobody has to believe anything that I'm saying. Everything that we've put out comes from reporting. We're looking back at the old reports, news articles, et cetera, that are out there. So this is all verifiable information. It's not a situation where I'm telling people, here's a story you've got to believe. I'm just giving you guys the evidence and the facts. So again, there's no indication of suicide anywhere along the flight path. You don't fly to the nearest airport that can accommodate a 777 during that. As I mentioned, there's no reason to avoid radar. They would have scrambled jets in some type of emergency situation or a hijack scenario, which never happened. There are, like, in terms of disabling the system, Captain Bellany suggests, and he was one of the investigators, that whoever was in command of the aircraft would have intentionally disconnected all four electronical generators and APU, but this is practically impossible for a single person to do that, especially within 64 seconds between the last reported communication to the public and when this plane went dark. The flight simulator, another huge piece of disinformation. The route that they try to connect to this is actually MH150 from Kuala Lumpur to Jeddah. He was actually scheduled to fly this route February 4th, 2014. The dates on those ping on that route is actually, I believe, February 2nd or February 3rd of 2014. So clearly he was just practicing his other route. This route doesn't even actually line up. The only part that even lines up is the part from Kuala Lumpur to the Andaman Sea. And even that is a poor approximation of going from the South China Sea back to Penang and then to the Andaman Sea in general. And then they use a single diversion point, which they claim they found in the system that was deleted, to try to connect it to that, to claim that, oh, this means that he was practicing flying into the South Indian Ocean. It just doesn't hold up. The guy had a custom simulator because he loves flying. So he would fly at home, practice flying at home, practice flying the routes he's going to do. So nothing about the guy's psychological profile or what he was doing adds up to any type of suicidal scenario.
Terrible situation for his colleagues, his family. the people who knew him, because it's 10 years and they still don't have any kind of suggestion as to precisely what happened. They have a lot of people putting in their 2 or 3 cents worth, but so far no more than that. What about the pieces of wreckage? I know you say that there was nothing really in terms of wreckage, but you know, there was, for example, what was claimed to be, and this has been disputed, but the door to the landing gear, or one of the doors to the landing gear that was said to have been found.
Yeah, and I haven't seen any doors to the landing gear at all that are out there. But real quick, what I want to say in terms of the pilot is I feel like they've been falsely vilified for 10 years. So if you can imagine somebody telling you that your husband or your father or your uncle was somebody who was a suicidal pilot, I think that one of the nephews of the pilots, according to Florence Chang, was told that they had known what happened to the plane and that their uncle was a collateral damage, which is a pretty dark thing to think about. Now, the debris that washed up over a year later, some of it even almost 2 years later, just want to repeat that no debris, not a single piece, was found by the official search, not above or below water, which was the most expensive search in history. They searched with 42 planes and 39 boats from over a dozen different countries. Some of the debris, actually, in fact, all the debris that's found is consistent with the event that we've put forth, with is this fire lithium ion battery scenario, plus this advanced technology, which we're calling a macroscopic phase conjugation event. You can just call it Star Trek warp drive, if you want to call it that. Some of the debris that was found actually has clear burn marks and scorch marks on it. And that debris has a honeycomb pattern, which is consistent with a Boeing airplane. So there actually is debris that has burn marks on it. This flaperon, which is clearly the biggest piece of the plane, they like to take pictures of it to make it look gigantic. But if you go look and Google CNN debris MH370, you'll find there's a diagram. There's only 3 pieces of the debris that have been confirmed, quote unquote, connected to the plane. And it's far less than 1% of the entire plane. It's basically nothing whatsoever. You have to realize how big these planes are in general. Now, the other thing that they don't tell you about this flaperon is it was matched with a non-unique serial number. The unique serial plate somehow washed off, even though this thing is bolted onto the flaperon. This actually delayed the confirmation of connecting it to MH370, which they later did by paint analysis and some part number that they found on there that the media reports as a serial number. And that's very misleading to a lot of people. Now, there's another plane, a 9M MRK, which is an exact replica of MH370 that was scrapped in October of 2013 that was purchased by GA Telesis as well. So there happens to be another plane out there that's an exact replica, but from Malaysian Airlines as well. Same exact model as 9M MRO, which is MH370. So I just want to point out to people this idea that we found a couple pieces of debris is not consistent with the plane crashing into the ocean. In fact, if the plane was on fire, these couple pieces of debris that fell off would be completely consistent with that type of event. Or if it's a situation where this plane went somewhere else, either some people like to say it was remote controlled and hijacked, whatever, you know, you can just tear off a couple pieces of debris afterwards, wherever it lands, and throw it into the water. The thing that doesn't make any sense is that we did not find a debris field. We should have found it the very next day. We've actually been able to prove that there is something called SBIRS, Space-Based Infrared System, Sentient, which is an AI that manages the satellites for the United States of America, and that there's enough satellites that they are scanning the whole globe persistently all the time. We would have found a debris field from this plane crash into the ocean the next day. The United States government actually stopped helping in the search after a month. So in my mind, they knew what happened to this plane. And this is my own country I'm talking about here.
That's a big assertion, and that's going to be a hard one for you to stand up, isn't it?
Not really. I think it's verifiable information. So when it comes to these videos, and I've spoken with the AARO, which is the All Domain Anomaly, I think, Resolution Office. I might have the R part incorrect. They're the ones in the United States that have been tasked with researching anomalous events, UAPs. UFO type events. I spoke with them, and this is what I told them, is that they should take this seriously because this is verifiable, actionable information. You can look up and see if an MQ-1C Gray Eagle with a camera underneath its wings for aerial surveillance looks like the camera that we're looking at here. We can look up and figure out from the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, and the NGA, the National Geospace Agency, whether or not their sentient SBIRS program and satellite video has this video recording capability like we see here. They're scanning the globe all the time. You can just Google SBIRS right now, S-B-I-R-S, Space-Based Infrared System. Go to the videos tab. You'll see the video from Lockheed Martin. I didn't think we would be able to find something like this. I didn't think something like this would even be public. You can just see them literally scanning the globe all the time, both with their geostationary satellites, which are 40,000 kilometers out that have Hubble telescopes on them, as well as you can see these Millennial Orbit satellites, which are the signals intelligence ones that communicate and relay the information. That video does not show the low Earth orbit satellites, but there's a number of them, including USA 229, which we were able to reverse engineer based on amateur historical trajectories to be right above the location at the Nicobar Islands, staring down at the coordinates we see in the satellite video, right where this plane supposedly turned into the South Indian Ocean at the right time. There's absolutely no chance whatsoever the U.S. government doesn't know exactly what happened to this plane.
Okay, I hear what you say, and there will be those, as you know, and I'm sure they will email me, and if you want me to, I'll pass on the emails to you who will disagree with that for reasons of their own. Last point in this segment, then. You're saying that it would have been impossible for traces of this plane, if a bad fate, which a bad fate must have befallen it, that's why it's missing. If a bad fate befell it, we would know. We would have seen the remnants of it. We would have seen what was left behind. And there was no way, which is what all of us, ordinary people and journalists, thought around the time the plane went missing. And I've left the most fascinating part of this to the last, Ashton Forbes talking about like MH370. The idea that the plane had a dangerous cargo, lithium-ion batteries that caught fire, the pilot was dealing with that, and that is the crux of this, but isn't entirely. There's another factor that we'll talk about in just a second. Just to get to this, the cargo is under question here, and always has been. What was in the cargo? How was it documented? How was it loaded? What became of it? Just some of the questions. What about the people who were on board there? Because there have always been suggestions that there were some very important people on board that plane. What do you know of that?
Yeah, the ones that are of high suspicion are probably both the Iranian passengers that were out there that were using stolen passports, and their story was they're supposedly going to Beijing to go to Amsterdam, which doesn't really make any sense if you're on stolen passports. Haven't been able to directly connect that to the scenario unless there's an espionage angle to the scenario that we've been presenting. But the other one is the 20 Freescale semiconductor scientists and engineers who were on board this plane. These were very important people related to Freescale Semiconductors, which was bought out the next year and turned into NXP semiconductors. Now, we were able to find, and again, this is a piece of evidence I never would have thought we'd be able to find, but a 2005 National Security Agency report by the United States on the commercial emergence of superconductive microchips, room temperature superconductive microchips. These are used in quantum computing. This report mentions Freescale Semiconductors 9 times, and it says that this technology could be available by 2010 or 2012, but only if the United States were to help fund it. So 20 people from the same company on board the same plane is far too many, especially if they're important people. Even my own company for my my real job or my normal job that I do would not let more than like 2 or 3 people from the same company be on board the same plane. So this is a high risk scenario. Now, in terms of what the motive might be then for, this, I think very clearly, if there's a fire scenario, the motive becomes a rescue, right? And then the idea here is that either, if you believe in this espionage angle, you could say that the United States, whoever is abducting this plane, is doing so to prevent these engineers from going to China, because we believe that this technology that they are talking about here with room temperature superconductivity is the basis for what we see in the videos to be real.
I have to say that there may well be people in the United Kingdom and wherever else people are listening to this shaking their heads now, because that does sound so unlikely without a whole ton of corroborating evidence. I take the point that why would you have so many important people on board a single plane, and most organizations insure against that sort of thing. I mean, insure against that kind of thing. However, it does sound a little far-fetched.
No, I'm sure it does. I think that even I would have had a hard time believing it before I saw 2 videos in perfect synchronization without a single discrepancy on a single frame. But once you see that, you can't just dismiss it out of hand. And I certainly don't think in those videos we're looking at 90s video game graphics. People have claimed that they can make these videos, but nobody seems to be able to come close to recreating them. So for the most part, I think that until we can rule out, those videos, or I think the other bigger thing is that regardless of how impossible something seems, once we've ruled out all other conclusions, we have to come back to those impossible possibilities. So with respect to these 20 engineers, we've got the evidence that says that they're linked directly to room temperature superconductive microchips. Mm-hmm. We've got the evidence that says they launched a major initiative dedicated to serving RF power needs for U.S. aerospace and defense. These are the people that are going to be the motivation for whatever happens to this plane. So it could be trying to prevent the intellectual property from, you know, going to China, as I mentioned, or just trying to keep the intellectual property at all. These people might be important in the development of advanced technology. You could also argue there might be one person aboard the plane who is a VIP, and they're calling in their rescue me button to the U.S. military saying, you got to save me. You could also argue, if these videos that we're looking at are real, that this is some type of test on a doomed plane. Because the reality is, if this plane lands in the ocean, it's probably not going to be a Sully Sullenberger situation. It's middle of the night. There's no light. Landing in the ocean is not the same as landing in the Hudson River. This plane is going to rip up into a million pieces. You need to have active people there, fishing people out of the water right away. And even then, probably a lot of people are going to die, if not everyone. So it's a very horrific scene and a horrific situation out there. And I do understand that what I'm presenting is extremely incredible. But again, at the same time, the amount of evidence lines up in a way where, you know, it's hard to get rid of. I mean, in these videos, we see smoke coming out of the back of the plane, and we know it's smoke, or I guess it could potentially be exhaust, but this plane is too low. The altitude is consistent with what Catherine T saw, 10,000 feet or under. We know that because we can see cumulus clouds that only form at very low altitudes, and we know that contrails only form at very high altitudes above 18,000 feet. We can see this plane descending in the videos, which again is consistent with both Catherine T's sighting as well as that Mayday call only reported in Chinese news. So once again, what I would tell your viewers is, you know, stuff may seem impossible out there, but so is a plane crashing into the ocean without leaving a debris field.
Well, we're always going to come back to that point, aren't we, Ashton? Because that's the Absolutely. One that nobody, no matter what side of this they come from, nobody can answer how it's possible for something to completely vanish without trace. And when you talk about all the other stuff, then you're into the realms of speculation, and it's just like the JFK case. People will be asking questions about this unless there's a smoking gun somewhere yet to be found. Unless that appears, people are going to be asking these questions, but they have a perfect right, as you do, to ask the questions. Now, this brings us to the most unlikely part of this. And it is fascinating, but a lot of people, again, will be shaking their heads at cosmic speed about this. The idea this plane has an emergency on board and is somehow teleported, what did you call it, a macroscopic phase conjugation event. Yep. I have no idea what that is. It's a fantastic bit of jargon enabled by this superconductivity that we were talking about. In other words, the idea that this plane was simply snatched away in the middle of all of that. Have I got that right?
You've got it. And quantum teleportation has been proven to be real. I think people need to take a look at the double slit experiment. We know there's something more to this world than what we see because of that experiment, which is repeatable, that shows that when we try to measure which of two slits a photon goes through, it seems to react. By just measuring it, the wave function breaks down. So what if we could rebuild that wave function? And what if we could do that on a macroscopic scale? Science is pushing the limit of that right now, even in the last few weeks it is. And I've been talking to engineers and scientists, physicists that say that this stuff checks out and that, you know, the public is just behind the times with respect to it. And this is what lends more credit to this idea that we have this macroscopic quantum coherence that's happening, that the properties denote the behavior, is that if you can get an object, even the size of a 777, size doesn't actually matter, to have the properties of something that's quantum, like an atom, then it can achieve the behaviors of that as well. So if you can reduce the mass of an object, this is really the key, is mass reduction. If you can reduce the mass of an object, perhaps by encasing it in a bubble, the same way that we see these orbs circling around the plane are in a non-radiating barrier, a bubble, especially of space-time, now that local mass becomes zero. And when that mass becomes zero, you can now, according to physics, have something achieve the speed of light, potentially even faster than the speed of light. I like to think of it as like an underlying matrix on which our reality is being projected onto. So as difficult as it is to believe, I think that what I would ask people is, do you think that we are at the pinnacle of scientific evolution right now? Or do you think that we're more like cavemen who've just discovered fire? And if we were to give those cavemen an iPhone, what would they say about it? They'd probably say the same thing that people are saying about the idea that you can teleport a 777.
I get everything that you say about this. Of course I do. And I'm really interested in the speculation, and I'm fascinated by the science here. One question, though, I mean, there are a number of questions, but one question here is that if it's possible to do this, why use this example to demonstrate it, and why hasn't it been demonstrated elsewhere since?
Yeah, I think that this is the kind of trump card that you only pull out at the last possible moment when you have to, because otherwise you are letting other countries catch up. Because the reality here is this is an ultimate weapon. If you turn it into something slightly different and a different derivative of this technology, you have a doomsday weapon that can destroy the planet. This is full military supremacy of the entire planet with this type of technology. You're not afraid of nukes. You're not afraid of anything with this type of technology that's out there. One thing I want to just harp on here as well, I think this part's important, is that we potentially identified the leaker of these videos. This is another reason why I think that they're so adamantly true, is that when I was investigating this, I thought, oh, I have a really good psychological profile for the person that leaked this. It's probably a U.S. military operator, because they removed the HUD data out of the drone. They crop out the drone from the satellite video.
Sorry, what's the HUD data?
The HUD data is the numbers and stuff that you see in these FLIR drone videos.
Got it.
What we're seeing here is something that's been a thermal layer on using the Raytheon cameras have been added to it, a rainbow palette. And usually they do that so that you can see more intelligence on them. It's not something that we've generally seen from videos that have been intentionally declassified to us. They released this video, according to the Regicide Anon account, they received it 4 days after the events of the plane. So this is an emotional reaction that somebody would have had. They would have seen this and they would have gone, they're never going to figure this out unless I leak these videos, right? They may even have to convince the person who uploaded it that they were authentic, because despite the fact that it says received March 12th, it wasn't uploaded, published until May 19th. It says source protected on this YouTube video that's out there as well, which seems to indicate that it would have come from somebody who would have been sensitive, classified information. That person may have even thought they were looking at UFOs, only to be later told that, no, this was our technology because of the description. Airliner video, airline and UFO, or satellite video, airliner and UFOs, doesn't say anything about Lockheed Martin secret orbs. So I eventually found, after several weeks, Lieutenant Commander Edward C. Lynn, very strange case. Everywhere I'm seeing on any news article is related to signals intelligence. And we've been sitting here talking about this is the way that all these assets are communicating, the satellites, the drone that we see, as well as the potential spy planes, the AWACS that Florence Achangi reported on, as well as in the Netflix documentary. Turns out this guy was part of the Special Project Squadron 2 Wizards, the VPU-2, flew in the Lockheed Martin EP-3 Ares 2 spy plane that has real-time tactical SIGINT and motion video intelligence. The code name for the charges against them were called Rogue Archer. It was last deployment was February 2014 to March 2016, but he gets reassigned March 25th. This is right around the time the plane went missing. The investigation began April 2nd. In May of that year, he accidentally left two flight manifests in his flight suit from a deployment that included search and rescue code names. This has to be MH370. The defense actually argued that the classified information in question is available on the internet. The FBI ran a sting operation on. They tried to claim it was an espionage case. It was the first major incident of espionage by an active duty member of the Navy since the Cold War. They tried to put him in life in prison. Everything about it has been redacted. They won't say anything about what the classified information that he released, even though just 2 days ago, there was another person that sold information to China, and they told us exactly what the information was that they were selling. He had very high top secret and compartmentalized access to top secret information. Turned out it wasn't really a spy case at all. A lot of stuff had been obfuscated by potentially the military and the media to make it sound like he was being charged with this prostitution, etc. He ended up taking a plea deal to just admit to the two charges that he was actually guilty of. This is according to him and his lawyer. And they still gave him 9 years in prison for dissemination of just classified material. This is a huge amount of time for someone to get for something that seems so light. Other people got nothing close to it. We even found the appeal document. And he even argues in the appeal that this is completely disproportionate with what other people of similar situation got.
But you can only speculate about this, can't you? You don't actually 100% know this. You can just put two and two together, like we said before, and make five.
I'm only 99.9% sure, of course. I can't be 100% sure, but I've been saying this guy's name for the last 3 months on every single podcast. I've done over 60 podcasts about this.
And has anybody come back to you? I know that you also did a big American radio show. Did you mention his name on that?
I've mentioned pretty much every single one that I can, and nobody at any point has ever come back to me and say, hey, stop saying my name. This is not what I got charged with in general. One of the last things I want to say about it is that he got 3 years shaved off for working with the NCIS and FBI. He would not be able to talk about these. He got out of prison probably a year or two ago. And if he ever spoke about these again, I'm sure his plea deal would send him back to jail. Plus, I think they probably convinced him that what he did hurt national security, and he's a patriot, and I don't think he'd want to release
And you're telling me here and now that no one has made any contact with you at all about any of this?
Nobody, not the families, not the leaker, no one in the government. I've heard from literally no one. No one in mainstream media will reach out to me, despite the fact that you would think a sensational story like this would be very interesting. A lot of podcasters want to because it gets huge amounts of views when we talk about this type of stuff because it's so out there.
I was going to say that. I mean, that is the reason why podcasters would want to do it. I can understand that. You know, who wouldn't want to do that? I suppose the question as we come up to the back end of this conversation, Ron Ashton, is if the plane was snatched away in this manner, where is it? Who's got it?
Yeah. So, and real quick, what I want to say is that I did FOIA the FBI and NCIS related to Edward C. Lynn case. FBI rejected it. The NCIS rejected it in total. I got a letter back from like the head legal counsel. And the exemption that they used was to be kept secret in the interest of national defense or foreign policy. Well, if this guy wasn't a spy, which the articles say that he was not, he was never agreed to any charge related to that. Why are they keeping this secret? How come every FOIA that I put out there is all being rejected for national defense and foreign policy, including one by O'Reilly Tates, who put one in back in 2014 to the NSA? If the U.S. government is not connected to this missing plane, how come they're rejecting all these FOIAs related to it? It's just a missing plane, right?
They may be doing it because the things that you're asking about are perhaps in some other way connected with national security. I mean, look, I'm not here to talk for them. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So now where did the plane go? Mm. I mean, I think that the answer is what everybody's been saying. Every single conspiracy theory out there says this plane went to Diego Garcia military base. This is going to be consistent with our sighting in the Maldives in the early morning as well. The
and
only reason why this was
239 people.
Yeah, 239. Now, did they survive this? I'm not sure. Reality is this is a very horrible event, and I want to send the condolences to the families of the victims here because you have a lithium-ion battery fire scenario, which is a very toxic fumes. The oxygen mask only lasts 20 to 30 minutes, and our scenario said it's got to last for an hour and 20 minutes before it gets to the place where the military intercepts it and teleports it with these orbs. And then after that, you've got to also then fly to Diego Garcia military base from the Maldives. So we don't have orbs on the, we don't have two videos on the other side to tell exactly what happened here. But, you know, the reality is that we don't know if they could even survive this macroscopic phase conjugation event that we're seeing. You know, would they get liquefied? Would they come out the same on the other side? Science says that when we do quantum teleport information, it doesn't get scrambled, which is, I guess, some good news, but I'm not a PhD expert in physics or engineering, so I can't say for sure.
Where did we get the technology from then? Do you think that aliens gave it to us?
My guess would be that what whistleblower David Grush has told U.S. Congress about crash retrievals, maybe even alien bodies. I'm not really sure about all that. So that's would have to be the answer. Or you could say that, you know, we didn't give up after in the 40s when we split the atom. You know, we've probably still been researching the last 80 years, right? To think that we haven't really gotten anywhere since then, that nuclear weapons are still our best technological advancement, that we're still driving around gas-powered cars. I think that people should question that. You know, have we really been stagnant, doing nothing? Or did we reach breakaway civilization level technology and deem that it is too dangerous to be made available to anyone? So there's also a Philip Wood picture that showed up about a week later on the 4chan website, which is really bizarre. It's a black picture, but when you look at the EXIF data, it has coordinates that point to Diego Garcia military base. It's a known CIA black site.
Sorry, who is Philip Wood?
In the past. He was the adult American passenger on board the plane, the IBM executive.
Sure.
And this post claimed that he was drugged and that he was being held against his will. So in my mind, again, yes, it is speculative. I'd be the first person to say that.
And what would you say, and I'm sorry, here I am jumping in. It's only because I've only got the clock ticking down on me right
now. Yeah.
What would you say, and it's not me saying it, but I can imagine people who would, that to come out with an explanation like this, is number one bad taste, and it's only going to upset the families, including the family of the gentleman you just referenced.
Yeah, the first thing is no families have ever reached out to me. None have ever said, hey, stop talking about this. I looked into the families. They've all been silenced from the settlements that they've been taking, which they've gotten very little, almost nothing. Between the $50,000 non-contingent payment they were given, the summary payments, because this was not tried in the United States, was only about $30,000 each. These people got nothing. That's 10 years. Some of these people lost their bread earners.
And you're saying that they've all had to sign the equivalent of NDAs about it?
Pretty much. They've the one guy who's still fighting in China essentially said that much on an article that was out there. I don't think that if I was a family member that lost my family, and even 10 years later, I would be desperate for any answers, even if it was some type of anomalous event that was out there. I think this idea that people put this, I call it the fake compassion argument. You're hurting the families. No, what hurts the families is lying about what happened to this plane, okay. Which is this plane was not a suicide. It didn't crash into the South Indian Ocean. There's no chance of it. That's what I think hurts the families. And I'm somebody out here who's just trying to get the truth that out, you know,
okay.
Whether that is that this plane was shot down, that maybe it was some type of suicide scenario. If it is this advanced technology out there, just following where the evidence leads. And that's what I think a good investigator needs to do.
So you're saying we need a bit more revelation here. We've got about 1 minute. Mm-hmm. In that 1 minute, can you tell me what you plan to do next?
Yeah, I think that what I would like out of anything is to get an answer from the U.S. government about this. I have been backdooring communications to people who are related to Congress and really anybody who's willing to listen. I've met more people, impressive people that I've ever met in my entire life related to this. In my mind, I'm certain that what we know about the plane is not what truly happened to it, that there is more to this in general.
Citizen journalist Ashton Forbes and his view of the demise of Flight MH370 and the fate of the more than 200 people on board. A very sad and very baffling case that will be back in the headlines for definite in March when the 10th anniversary rolls round. It is, for everybody involved, an awful tragedy, and we have the deepest feelings of sympathy for the families and the loved ones of those involved in this case. Ashton Forbes, his group is called MH370X. That's what he is known as in this context. And if you put that title into a search engine, you'll find ways, if you want to, if you need to contact him. More great guests in the pipeline here at the home of The Unexplained Online. So until we meet again, my name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained. And please, whatever you do, stay safe, stay calm, and stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.